You're listening to Alien X Radio, and this is your afternoon interview. I promised you a special guest. Listen to this music for a little bit. See if you can recognize this music. If you're a zombie movie fan at all, then you recognize this, the theme music from Night of the Living Dead. Well, guess what, everybody? On the line right now, I have Mr. Gary Striner, all up involved in Night of the Living Dead. Gary, how you doing?
I'm doing great, man. How are you?
I am awesome tonight. Thank you very much for joining me. I know you got a busy schedule and everything. I thank you for taking the time.
It's always great to talk about Night of the Living Dead.
Always. Absolutely always great. It is my favorite genre of all time is zombies. I've always loved zombie movies. Actually, I remember the very first one I actually saw was Dawn of the Dead. And then I went back and, of course, seen the original, the Night of the Living
Right.
Dead. Thank you very much for that.
People have done that. A lot of the younger people have actually gone like all the way forward to Diary of the Dead and Land of the Dead and then work their way back to Night. But it's quite amazing when you get out there at conventions and so forth to find out how many, 14-year-olds, 17-year-olds are into this film. And I think to some degree it's more popular now than it was, way back when.
Oh, for sure. For sure. It's like that with a lot of bands, too. An album will come out and somebody will hear a couple songs and they'll go, oh, hey, did you hear that new band? You go, new band? That band's been around for 25 years. Here, check out this. And now they're a big fan of music that came out before they were even born. And that is definitely
right.
The way it goes with the whole Of the Dead series.
Exactly.
Well, you were obviously you were involved in the original one, 1968, Night of the Living Dead, George A. Romero. Talk a little bit about what you did on the set. What was your major responsibilities?
My main function was I was the sound engineer. I recorded all the sound that you hear, and my brother was Russ Striner, was Johnny, who was the brother in the cemetery, and we always, of course. He always gets the crowds at his table because he came up with the line, "They're coming to get you, Barbara." And I keep telling people, if it wasn't for me, you'd have never heard that line. Little brotherly competition going on there. But otherwise, there were very few people involved with it. It was an extremely low-budget film. People are shocked when I tell them they're probably on most days, except for ones where... we had a lot of ghouls. There had a lot of extras to be made up. It was probably done with a five-man crew, where a Hollywood film would that be like minimum of 60-man crew and upwards of 120-man crew. So that's how we were able to do it, and that's how we were able to pull it off. And we had $35,000 hard cash into it, so. We couldn't be too lavish about everything. So we were very lucky that we had a production company called the Latent Image, and the Latent Image was going on for several years, doing industrial films and commercials and travel log films and things like that. So. We were able to amass all the equipment that we needed, so we didn't have to go out and rent anything or buy anything. We were already, all we really needed to do was we put the 10 original, the corporation that actually produced Night of the Living Dead was called Image 10, and that was because there were 10 original investors, and we all put in $600, and that was our seed money. That once we had that in, we were able to buy film, and the rest is history.
Yeah, it is.
It seems so simple.
Yeah,
and it was. Yeah. It truly was. I think that, who know, people say, well, did you know back then that it was going to be a cult classic? Well, of course we didn't. You know, how could you possibly know that?
Right.
The only thing we knew that, you know, we knew that we wanted it to be the scariest movie that we could possibly make. And I think we exceeded even our own expectations with that. And of course, you know, hats off to George Romero, not only as the director of it, but I've said this many times. I think that George is one of the best film editors that I've ever come across. His sensibilities to editing are just magnificent. I would use the scene in the basement where young Karen Cooper actually takes her mother with the with the trowel, and that scene's all frequently compared to the knife scene, the shower scene in Psycho.
Oh, sure.
And that took us about, I'm going to say 2 hours to shoot Kyra and Marilyn's scene, and it took them a week to shoot the scene in Psycho. And I think people have said that the one in Night was actually more terrifying to them, more suspenseful. But anyway, I mean, it's not a competition. The fact is that George was a remarkable editor.
If I'm editing two people having a conversation or even a fight scene, it's a lot easier to edit that than it is just simply zombies walking across a parking lot, because
right.
The nature of a zombie is so random that no two shots of these zombies are going to line up. It's just not going to happen. All the staggering, the stumbling, and it's very difficult. You think you've got a nice cut, and then all of a sudden this person jumps or moves from cut to cut, and you got to start all over again.
Yeah. Well, with dialogue, you have somewhere to hide, you know. You have cutaways, and that's the tough thing, as you're saying, doing those matches and figuring out, you know. I mean, it's nice if you have, you know, two camera coverage on stuff that you can cut with, but of course that was completely out of the question. Everything was shot with single camera on Night. It has its little continuity issues from time to time, but you know, over time, they've also become part of the charm of the film, and it's mm-hmm. very, you know, it gives the fans something to talk about. I mean, they really do. They'll, you know.
Sure. There's fans out there that are in, just like in baseball, you know, they can tell you what player on what day hit what average and all this. Well, they can also tell you in what film, at what point in the film, there's a picture hanging on the wall, which is for a concert for a band that didn't come out for 13 years after the movie, you know, things like that.
Right.
Yeah. I know what you're saying.
Paul McCartney was on the David Letterman show a couple of years ago, and I thought it was funny because David Letterman asked him how long before the Beatles came to the Ed Sullivan show were they popular in London. And McCartney just got this blank look on his face, and he just shrugged his shoulders, and he goes, 2 weeks? You know, he said, that's really not a question to ask me. That's a question to ask fans. Fans will tell you they'll tell you what time our plane left to go to the Ed Sullivan show. It's
right.
Like we were living it. We weren't. And it's very true. I mean, had we known what was going to happen with the film, a lot of things would have been different. First of all, we would have never let the copyright slip by, but that was, you know, that was something that happened, and it just happened. There's nothing you can do about it. But, you know, I mean, like collectibles and things like that, you know, we had no idea at the time. We would have had that whole house in some sort of a museum somewhere had we had any, you know, idea of where the film was going to go. So I think that, fans, that's all they have to do. Fandom is what that's all about. It's piecing those things together. And, you know, we find out things that happened 45 years ago all the time. There was a lot of controversy, and we didn't really know. The farmhouse that we shot in was a real jewel because we knew it was going to be torn down after we were done filming. They were going to put a sod farm in on that property, so it was perfect for us. We didn't have to worry about anything we destroyed. Nothing had to be replaced or repaired. So we could hammer into, you know, door frames and window frames and, you know, not worry about the consequences.
Nice.
And then the question became, then we, you know, we wrapped the film and we went off on our merry way and never really paid any attention to it. We knew it was going to be ripped down, but we never knew when. As it turns out, I mean, this is now, well, this was last year, so 44 years later, a member of our Facebook group happened to be part of the crew that tore it down. He lived here in Evans City and oddly enough happened to be a neighbor of mine for a number of years up here. And, you know, and he confirmed that it was not, it was there for a year after the fact, you know. So there's things out there being sold as original pieces of the film, props, so on and so forth, that, you know, claim to have authenticity, you know, certificates, this, that, and the other thing. And it's like, well, I was there. I can tell you that was not in the film. And so, you know, there's tons of things like that that continue to make it interesting, you know.
Right. Now you said that you were on the sound crew. I, you know, obviously through some experience of my own and just knowing other people that make movies, I've seen some sound people hanging from ropes from the ceiling. I've seen them up on, let's say, questionable ladders or scaffolding. I mean, what would you think would be the craziest position that you found yourself? Because this is obviously, you said it was a lower budget, so you don't have, and even, you know, back then you wouldn't have had these trucks and scaffolding and things. What would have been the most dangerous position you put yourself into to get the sound?
It was never too dangerous because I never had a boom man. You know, when you say sound crew, it was a crew of one for the most part. I mean, again, as I said, a few days, and that was a shared responsibility. You know, I not only did sound, but I was the assistant cameraman and helped with, you know, setting lights. You know, there was a crew of five. So
it was all hands on deck.
A little bit of everything, but you know, it was just one of those things. We didn't have a boom man, so I had to watch, you know, the scene as it was being blocked, and George was obviously running through it to figure out his camera angles and the movement and talent and so forth. And I had to pick a common place, you know, where most of the sound was going to be delivered, and that's where I put the fixed boom. You know, it was really no more complicated than that. And, you know, we did very little looping. I mean, we did wild track on everything, as you do just for safety, but very little of it was used. You know, it was just good mic placement, you know, you know, I was lucky, I guess, in any respects.
No luck. It was a good job. It was all skill and talent.
Yeah, there's a few places I still say, you know, I cringe every time I hear it. There are things that you wanted to be different, some distortion or this or that, you know. But I think that so little regard is paid to sound in general on independent films, and I think it's a lot of films really suffer for the fact that, you know, if you can't hear the dialogue or you're trying to, you know, piece together what somebody's saying, and then they're moved on to something else, it really diminishes the, I think, the experience and the pleasure of a film. So I will say that at least in Night, everything is completely legible, and I've actually been complimented on it, and, you know, for an independent film. And basically, I mean, I would say the same thing. For the way it was done, I mean, had I had even a boom man, you know, it would have just been, it could have been so much better. But considering all the resources available, that was it.
Did you know George Romero before this film got underway, or did you know? Were you with him?
Oh yeah, yeah. We had, as I said, we had worked together, I think, for 4 or 5 years prior to that in a little company called The Latent Image, and so yeah, so we were very familiar, and you know, we had the same sort of guerrilla style production there as well. You know, we were in Pittsburgh, PA. It wasn't like at that time in the 60s, you know, there we were it. You know, we were probably the most technically proficient group in the city.
Now, I've had different guests on here too. I've had David Crawford from Dawn of the Dead. I don't know if by chance you've run into him at the Comic Cons and stuff, or if you knew him already, or.
Yes. I mean, I don't know him well, but I know we've done several conventions together.
Yeah, he was on my show as well, and he talked a little bit about how much he enjoyed the Comic-Con circuit as far as going out there and talking to people, signing the autographs and things. And I imagine that you do the same thing for all the movies that you've been involved with, and how do you feel about the whole Comic-Con phenomenon?
Well, you know, the great thing about it is, and I didn't do them for a long, long time because I kind of went off and had another career, and I worked in advertising, and so I really was like completely away from night, and then I came back, and I retired from all that, and I moved back to Pennsylvania, and I couldn't for the life of me in the beginning figure out why anybody would want to talk to me about Night of the Living Dead. And that's just, you know, being naive, I guess, but I never realized what this fandom was all about. And to me, I think it's such a mutual admiration. The fans, of course, love you for what you did. And I maintain that if the fans didn't like it and the fans didn't pick up on it, whatever we did would have been somewhat useless. So that symbiotic need, I think, for both to appreciate is really very high. And so I love talking to fans. And they do appreciate the history of Night as well, and a good fan of horror knows where it came from. And I'm talking about modern horror, you know. I'm talking about not the Frankenstein era, not the, you know, the early classic era, but I'm talking what is considered modern day horror, which started in 1968, and that's, you know, It changed course there, you know, with Night of the Living Dead, and so anyway, I think that the fans are appreciative of it, and it's always wonderful to talk to them, and you know, they all have stories, they all have their, you know, memorabilia that they've been collecting for a long time, and to get another signature on a poster or a DVD cover is so important to them, and I love it. I don't do them as much as. It comes and goes, you know. I mean, I think there's a burnout rate in them too, and there's so many of them, so many.
Well, sure, it would be. Yeah, you wouldn't. I'm sure that you would get tired of traveling around and go to one and go to another one, and after a while, it would become kind of you know, redundant doing the same things, you know, over and over again. So you definitely would want to pace those out.
Yeah, and same for the fans. I mean, if you're at every show, then there's nothing particularly special, you know. So. I did a little thing over the last 2 years. The chapel in the cemetery where Evan and Lily shot Night of the Living Dead, in the opening scenes, we were never in it. It was always background. It's, you know, it's in the scene where Bill Hinesman is smashing the window of the car. You can see it. And when Johnny and Barbara get out of the car, but it had fallen into disrepair. And they were going to tear it down because they didn't have the money to fix it. So I started a group called Fix the Chapel, and we ended up raising about $47,000 to put this building right again. So that was another connection with the fans. And I did do a lot of conventions for that, you know, just as for fundraisers. So then that was good too, and the fans are so proud that, you know, that they came up with this cash to be able to save what they feel is history.
Yeah, so you do a movie in 1968. You use the fame from that to do good later on. I mean, it's an awesome thing. I don't see. I mean, it's a win-win situation. It seems like anytime anybody takes something that happened, you know, some movie that they did a long time ago, people say, "Well, why are you trying to live on something you did a long time ago?" I'm not. That's something I still am. You know, it's something I'm proud of.
Right.
And I can make something good happen because of it. So what's wrong with that?
Yeah, no, there's absolutely nothing wrong with it. And, you know, I had a career after Night of the Living Dead, but Night of the Living Dead will always be the cornerstone of my career. It just, that's, I can't take that away or make that go away or anything else. I mean, Night of the Living Dead was a major milestone in my career. And why would I want to forget it, or why would I want to walk away from it? You know, I mean, it's using that to, I don't know, to carry on, I guess I would say. You know, it's not like you're lingering in that era, you know. It's not like I...
Right.
Like I never got out of 1968.
Right, exactly, exactly. It's just something that you're proud of. So, I mean, that hasn't changed. It's not something that suddenly you're not proud of. I mean, it's an accomplishment that how many people can say, how many people out there can actually say, well, I was involved in a movie that came out in 1968 that is as relevant as and important today as it was back then, even, of course, a lot more, and that almost everybody in the country knows. You know what I mean? It's like they know it.
Oh, it's the power of Night of the Living Dead is, I say specifically with this project that I did to the fundraiser to fix the chapel. If this was just a, you know, a building in a cemetery somewhere in western Pennsylvania, I would have had about $800, you know. But the fact that it was Night of the Living Dead put it over the top and got us the amount of money we needed to fix it.
Yep. And come today, I guarantee you more people have seen and can recognize Night of the Living Dead than Casablanca, something like that. You know, I guarantee you. It's the truth. It's the truth. Because you appeal to a larger audience. You appeal to the entertainment of a much larger audience. You did. And I thank you very much for your contribution to the horror film industry. Thank you very much.
Well, it was a pleasure. It was a pleasure. I thoroughly enjoyed it.